Hello and welcome to episode 7 of series 2 of the Agents Folk podcast. My name is Tim Cox, I'm your host. And today I'm really excited to be talking to a really exciting trainee, soon to be fully qualified educational psychologist, Patrick Langford, who I first kind of came across in a kind of curious way at the TEP conference in 2020, talking about open psychology and open education psychology. And we're going to have a chat about that today. But before we get into that, I'll allow Patrick to introduce himself and tell us a bit about how he came to be having this conversation.
Definitely. Thank you very much for having me on. So obviously, as with everyone, well, not obviously as with everyone, I had my undergrad psychology. But before that, I knew I wanted to be an educational psychologist from about the age of 16. But I was reflecting on this the other day. I didn't actually know what an educational psychologist did or was until about the first year of the doctorate, maybe even the second year before I had like a full grasp of that. So even though I wanted to be an educational psychologist, didn't really know what that meant, liked the idea of it. And so after undergrad, did my teaching qualification. And I think towards the end of that, so this was about 2014, maybe the end of 2013, that's when I started coming across this idea of, I'll loosely call open science, because I started reading some blogs online, specifically Neuroskeptic and Neurocritic, and they talked about criticizing psychology, not from a stance of like tearing it down, this is all rubbish, but from a stance of we want to improve it, we want to make it better. So we're critiquing the methods and trying to raise the overall standard. And that kind of led me onto Twitter and into that psychology world, I guess, on Twitter. And a big part of that, the community that I found myself in, was critiquing methods and critically analyzing the way that science was done. And I think that really resonated with me. And it's certainly become more strong for me going forward, because obviously being an educational psychologist, a lot of what we do is taking that meta perspective, got to critique things, critically analyze them. And so I think that not training so much, but that kind of starts beforehand led me nicely into that. And I think I naturally, as a person, quite like taking that meta perspective and thinking about things. So that really resonated with me. And then open psychology and the idea of improving methods and everything really came into, certainly for me, and also I think in public consciousness around about 2015, when there was the open science collaboration. I can't remember the exact terminology, the exact name of it, but there was a quite famous study where they took 100 studies, tried to replicate them, psychological studies, tried to replicate them, and only like a third of them did. And this was like quite shocking, because the general consensus was that the findings that we read about in the literature are robust, are genuine, reflect reality, and we can then draw conclusions based on them. And this kind of opened a lot of people's eyes, including mine, this idea that maybe it's not quite as robust as we thought it was. And this started something called the replication crisis, which is broadening right now, because we're not that we're realizing, because people have been talking about this for decades. Like, you can go back to the 50s and 40s and people will be talking about these issues, but it's becoming much more of a general issue around how we understand the literature, what is real, what is a genuine effect, what is a robust effect, and how we explore that in a meaningful way. And this world never really, I was really interested in it, but it never really integrated with my professional work, because I was a teacher and that was super interesting and obviously quite difficult, but I enjoyed it. I then worked as in a specialist school for about a year or so, and then did my master's at the IOE before getting on the doctorate. And during the master's, there was a little, I could bring in a little bit of it, but there was never any real discussion of that open science stuff. So it was very much a side project that I was interested in, trying to better understand statistics, better understand methodology. And so as I've gone on in my career, it's come into focus more, mainly because with my thesis, I could try and integrate these practices and principles a lot more. And as you said, I gave that talk at DCP, which I really enjoyed, about open psychology, about open educational psychology. and trying to sort of marry those two things together, because I think it's really important that we think about these things. But the last thing I want to do is be like haranguing people and saying like, you have to do this, because that's really unpleasant for everyone. That's not my personality. I don't like to do that. And I want to try and offer these things up to people as a way of thinking about research, about critiquing it, because I'm sure there's loads of, even specifically within education psychology, there's loads of people who either do research, consume research, where these ideas will resonate around how can we be sure these effects are robust and real and all these sorts of things. So I want to try and marry those sorts of two things more, and also do what I espouse. I want to try and share, specifically with my thesis and all future research that I do, I want to share the materials, I want to share the data and all these other things, and try and be an example of that. And also, if anyone wants to ask and everything, talk about that, give advice and everything. So I find it really interesting. I really, really like it.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I think you were possibly first year when you delivered that tech conference, 2020.
I was.
Perhaps.
Yes.
Know. Yeah, you must have been.
I should really know. Yeah. Time's lost all meaning. I'm very sorry.
Yeah. And I was just like, I went to it because I was like, I read the title of your talk, and I think it was the first or second talk of the day. And I thought, I don't know what that means. I have no idea. And albeit I've come to psychology in a quite kind of, I came through history and then working in education, and then found that actually qualitative research for psychology fits a lot with historical sort of, I guess, Marxist with a small M history, where you're looking at life story and those sort of things.
Very much so.
So I came into that talk kind of thinking, and it was, it was certainly the way I interpreted it from my master's conversion, was that if your worldview is qualitative, or you find the statistical approach problematic or difficult, you'll probably just see things in a qualitative way. Now, that pragmatically kind of worked for me in my master's, and I tried to do something that was relatively mixed methods, because actually, as a school practitioner, kind of working in kind of pastoral middle management, I'd always take a data-driven view of, this tells us a story as well as the stories of the children we're working with, but we can focus our time effectively by looking at these, 10 children who have 40 plus behavior points or something like that. That just makes sense to do, and really try and understand their story. So try to do it that way. And I'd read a few books about, questioning science and questioning eugenics and stuff like that. That's the obvious, the obvious thing why you don't take the average, or you have to think about weird participants or whatever it is. But I never thought about it in the way that you presented it, about being open and ethical. And a couple of episodes we had Chris Bagley talking about challenging the education system. What you did in that talk was challenge a system within our ecology, really, which is just accepted at face value if you haven't come into those ideas about open science and open psychology. And for me, that changed. I came out of that thinking about psychology in a different way. And I don't think, although I wouldn't say that Agents of Hope is an open science thing, but what I'm trying to do is have a transparent conversation about why people think the way they do, and apply the ideas in the way that they do, so that other people have a chance to think about it if they're not in the profession. So those ideas came from your talk, and I've sort of kind of Frankensteined them to become my own particular monster. But I guess what probably would be helpful for people who weren't at that talk was if we kind of get a loose definition of kind of what open science, open research, open access stuff means.
Absolutely. And I'm really glad that the talk had a positive impact, because that was kind of exactly what I was hoping to do, just present that and offer it up as an opportunity to think about. Open science is really broad, and there are many strands within it. And it's, I understand it as the general movement, desire, drive to make the research that we do, and by extension, as you're talking about, the way that we practice, more open, more able to be criticized, rather than hiding it behind really obscure methods or paywalls, which we'll definitely be talking about, or other things like that, trying to be honest as well, because research specifically is very, very hard. And there is a huge amount of pressure within the systems that we operate to craft a narrative, to say that we planned all these things from the very beginning, to maybe, if there's a few outliers, to drop those, if there's variables that we tested, which this is specifically with quantitative, but qualitative is something I definitely want to explore as well, because I think it's really valuable. Dropping those, pretending that they were never there. So creating this false narrative around this story, because especially with the quantitative stuff, by doing that, you are undermining the integrity of the statistics that you're using. And then with qualitative, within the past 2 or so years, I've really come to appreciate qualitative research, because beforehand, I didn't really know what it was. I didn't understand it, and I didn't value it. So I thought, that's just talking to people. What does that tell us? And then the more that I found out about it, I'm actually, no, this is a really valuable, really useful way to understand ourselves, the world, whatever. And that's why I've done a mixed methods for my thesis. But there's still that value in having open qualitative research. To take an easy example, if you have thematically analyzed some interviews, putting the codes, putting the transcripts with the highlighted codes up on a public repository so other people can check them if they wanted to, because qualitative research makes it really explicit that your personal standpoint will have an impact. It's not feigning objectivity, which one could argue statistics does. And so you can then go and check if you so desired. Obviously, you don't have to do that, but it's just giving people the option to explore that and see, okay, so you've explored this area, you've made these codes, how did you code it? Because you could go and see that, oh, they made a mistake, or they've coded this in a way that I don't think is justified, but from your standpoint, it makes sense. But that then opens up a dialogue around different ways of interpreting it, specifically within qualitative. And with quantitative, it does largely the same thing. It's making those assumptions, making those methodologies, the results as well, open, because quite often with a scientific paper, you only see the summary results, the results of the test. You don't see the data underneath. You don't see all the tests that have been done. And so being open is about making that thing clear, making it explicit, rather than, as I said, hiding behind some kind of fancy button pressing in SPSS or something like that.
There's a real kind of, from a naive point of view, there's a common sense. There's a common sense to doing that. There's a common good to doing that. So I guess the next question would be, so we kind of have an understanding of what open science and psychology is. Why don't we already have it?
Oh my days, that's such a good question. And yes, because I completely agree. We should be doing all of these things, because also some of them are more difficult, like pre-registration, which I can talk about in a minute, and other things are different and so seem more difficult. But taking your data, putting it up on a public repository so anyone can access it in just an Excel sheet isn't a huge amount of work. And there is a lot of benefit to be gained from that. But we don't do it because, well, there's a lot of reasons. One of the big narratives around why we don't do it is the incentive structure. The incentive structure specifically within academia is you publish as much as possible, you publish as fast as possible, you create these sexy results which confirm your hypotheses. And so everything is stacked against you doing, I say better in quote marks, because obviously there's a debate we had about whether it's better or not, but more open and being better able to critique that research. And those incentive structures of having to publish lots, you being judged by the quantity of first author publications, these don't encourage you to slow down, to really think about it, to then put in the time to make your data open. It also actively discourages you, because if you make your data open, someone can examine your data, maybe analyze it in a different way and get a publication out of it, which is then something that you can't do with that. So it's the traditional way of understanding science. It's very combative. It's every person's out for themselves. You're trying to really quickly push forward, gaining all the advantages you can, hoarding your resources, not letting others have it. And it breeds this culture of everyone looking out for themselves, because why would you want to really, obviously there are lots of amazing people within academia who support others, who provide really great work, but when it comes to their research, they are actively discouraged, because you're less likely to get promoted or become professors or whatever if you are spending time teaching, if you're spending time making your resources available, if you're helping others, whereas if you're just on that publication grind, you're going to get further ahead. And so this entire system is against that. And then a big part of this as well is that publishing companies hold so much power, because they control access to the papers that are written. It's crazy, because if you think about how the system works and the number of people you see this happen on Twitter for, you think about it for like 5 seconds, it's like, this is madness. This makes absolutely no sense, because the researchers write the paper, they review it for free, they then have to pay to access the thing that they have made. And so it's just completely bizarre. And what a consequence of that is, anyone who doesn't have an access to a university because they're not affiliated with the university or whatever, they can't access these papers. And this is really relevant for educational psychologists, because most practicing EPs are not affiliated with the university. So if they want to, obviously setting aside questions around how much time they have or whatever, but if they wanted to read a paper, keep up to date with the literature or whatever, you'd have to ask the training EPs in your EPS to send it to you, because you don't have access to it. And it's so bizarre. Obviously it's come about because of that obvious profit motive, because these publishing companies make like literally billions in profit a year. So there's real power structures there keeping this status quo going, but it just undermines our ability to collectively have a better understanding of what's going on. Because if so many practicing, focusing specifically within educational psychology, if so many EPs can't access these sorts of things, how are they going to know whether something they are promoting is evidence-based or not? And obviously we work in trade services, so being evidence-based is much more at the forefront. I would argue that we should always be evidence-based, because I really like that meta perspective, as I was saying earlier, and I really enjoy exploring those sorts of things. But the way that the system works just makes it so much harder. And this ties into something that we were chatting about beforehand, this access to papers, not just for researchers, but what is the purpose of the research that we do? Is it to further our careers? Is it to provide better methods for us to help young people? Is it, and also a lot of it will be helping to better understand our profession, the people that we work with. And so if the professionals themselves can't access the papers, parents, teachers, anyone else that we might work with have no chance of seeing any of this. And so it again furthers this mentality, probably not consciously, but this conception of academia as cloistered away from people, as being in that ivory tower. And so it makes it so much harder to be accessible. And I think something that I hold to personally is that we should be trying to, I think giving away psychology is a phrase that comes up quite often, specifically within the context of consultation, but I do think it applies in general. We should be trying to, whatever we develop, the results that we find, we should be spreading those out, because that's really important for us. It's important for people that we work with to better understand what we are doing, why we might be doing something. And so just creating that shared sense of understanding, because it goes back to what I was saying earlier about how we conceive of research and what we are doing as academics rather than, say, practicing psychologists. But is the purpose to further our careers, or is it to better help those who are that we work with and our colleagues? And if it's the latter, then we should really be trying as best as we can to make these things available. Even if, say, someone, academic does research on something and they use a method, they use statistics, and most people reading it can't understand those specific statistics, that's perhaps not the most important part. Maybe someone who is reading it can critique it or whatever, but just getting the results out, getting those ideas out to a wider audience, rather than it just being 15 academics sending papers backwards and forwards and not having any real impact beyond their H index going up. And so I think that's something that the more I think about open science and the more I think about the kind of educational psychologist I want to be, I see that they are much more overlap. There's a lot more overlap when I first realized than when I first joined, because I thought they would be quite separate. But for me, those mentalities align quite nicely.
Yeah, I think there's, I think a couple of things from what you've said there, is very rich. But I think there's what I picked up is this sort of kind of theme initially of, research can become a currency of influence in academic circles rather than objectivity about, the scientific method of seeing, human life, human behaviour that psychology purports to do. And therefore, when we're drawing on evidence-based practice, evidence-based research, that's why we have to have the criticality of where that evidence base has come from. And I was just thinking in when I did my methodography around for my thesis around fathers' involvement in their children's development, what came through a lot of the papers was this kind of idea around being a responsible father, which comes from US health policy, which is like fathers should be old enough to make decisions to have children, be old enough to be able to support that child in financial and social means, and maintain a good relationship with the mother. And although it was qualitative research, for three or four of the papers out of the five that I looked at, looked at it this way, even though they weren't in, so they were looking at like Japanese fathers, or they were looking at Botswanan fathers or South African fathers. And the consequence of that is that the researchers it was actually Colombia, Botswana, and Japan, but they were all saying that, well, we should encourage our fathers to be more responsible, even though it's an idea that's come from, a particular time, a particular place. But it's taken as objectively, this would make a good father, even though they're saying it doesn't really fit with our marriage structure or our family structure. This is what we should do. And, that was sort of my conclusion on the research, is that we have to hold criticality over why are the researchers going down a certain line of argument, and what does it fit in the kind of the home of that idea. So there was that idea of also something that came strongly through that weirdly came up in my history dissertation at undergrad, where I was looking at who informed ideas about death in medieval England, is that you had this sense in churches and church communities in England in medieval times of the literati, who were the priests who could speak Latin and could basically commune with God. That was the idea. And the illiterati of people who had to follow what the priest said, essentially. And you've got this sort of, that structure has kind of seems to have shifted over to this sense of, well, we know objective science and we'll tell you what it means. And we'll follow our own sort of ideas. And
we have our own practices, own rituals that are followed, the key values, importing those objective methods. And we will then divine them from the gods and tell you illiterati about them.
Yeah.
That's such a good analog.
There seems to be this kind of shift. And I'm sure this waves a bit, but particularly as YouTube and podcasts have become more thing, is that actually, if you verbally explain scientific ideas to people, they get it. So, you know,
the democratizing of these ideas and broadening it out to more people, definitely. And people being able to,
I don't think that has to make it like populist science, but it can make it what you're suggesting would make it actually, let's do things actually objectively and just see what happens rather than follow hypotheses and publish the science that does that. And that was a real kind of key thing that I hadn't thought about, but in your TEP conference talk, was like, it seems that a lot of the things get published are the things that follow that journal's particular narrative about science.
Very much so, yeah. Like the editors might agree with this hypothesis, so it's more likely to be published. There's a lot of critiques of peer review, which we can discuss if you want. And the traditional way of doing things is generally believed to be the arbiter of truth. If it's been published and it's been peer reviewed, it is real, it's robust. And what we're seeing very, very apparently, and as I said, people have been talking about this since like probably even before the 40s, but more so recently, that something being published is not a real, it's a very weak signal of quality, because a lot of stuff is published that you look at it and it's methodologically unsound. It's so specific to a certain group that it can't then be, you can't then be certain it generalizes beyond that population. It uses statistics incorrectly if it's quantitative. And so, this idea that a published paper is sacrosanct or is very, very strong, whatever, is just, it's starting to fall apart, that idea. And I think it ties into what we were saying earlier, trying to democratize that, to try and make it more accessible, but also perhaps be a bit more humble as well in the conclusions that we draw, because the research that we're doing is usually quite narrow in scope, especially if it's just one person doing it or a very small team doing it. It's going to be much more narrow in scope. And so rather than drawing these huge generalizations that I tested 25 English undergrads on a certain task, deleting letters from a story, and that then tells us about grief or some, it could be anything. And so you do get these studies where the methodology is just so far removed from what they're actually studying that it's almost has no meaning. But because it's a published paper, it then tells us something really valuable. And trying to be more open about this, being more critical of them, I think is important and allows us to have a better understanding of what, of the limits of that. Because we've got, I think, something that really struck me as I was sort of becoming very slowly more aware of these sorts of things, is the false confidence that is generated by a lot of research, because we have these really strong conclusions. And again, this is all part of the incentive structure saying that we need to have these super strong conclusions to get publications. And so it pushes us to have these huge statements, whereas open science in general is about, I would say it's about being a bit more humble, about being open that this was conducted on this specific group of participants at this time, and maybe it might not generalize to another culture or critique, or opening up opportunity for critique. And obviously, with the way that science is structured, that makes it really hard, because if you're being more modest in your claims and you're then opening yourself up to critique, that's putting you at a risk, because someone could say this paper is rubbish or this result is rubbish, but it's more genuine, it's more real, and we can feel more confident that it's actually being critiqued rather than just hiding behind all these methods or hiding behind a paywall literally so you kind of read it. So it's something that I think, as I said, is really important, but I think is potentially, I don't know how feasible this is, but in my mind, if practicing psychologists are doing research, I feel like there'll be less pressure to publish in the same mold as someone who's like just an academic who's just doing research. They'd have a lot more pressure because their job is dependent on that structure. Whereas if there are practicing psychologists who are also doing research, I feel like the pressure there is a lot less because they have the security of being a practicing psychologist. And I think for me going forwards, I definitely want to do more research because I really, really enjoy it. And something that I really want to do is making sure that all my data is open, that you can then go and check to see if I've made a mistake because I'm human. You can check the methods that I've used to see if you think, even if you don't need to have a really detailed understanding of methodology or validity or that kind of statistics or anything, but just being able to look at it and think, does this really make sense? Or if I'm doing qualitative work, thinking about, okay, what biases am I coming with? And just being open about those and being open to an honest discussion around that. And if I develop any methods, making them open. And one thing for me that's really important, as we talked about earlier, is the idea of having it open so people can read, because specifically with my thesis, I've had a few people say, oh, they'd like to read it. And for me, if I were to then publish my thesis or whatever, and then not make that available, that would defeat the whole point, because my thesis is about consultation and almost all psychologists use consultation. And I think it's a really important way of working. And I think my thesis is kind of good. I kind of want people to read it. And so making those things available is really important to me, because A, if I didn't do it, make me a hypocrite, but also I think it could help people going forwards. And yeah, that's something I want to try and do.
Yeah, it's something that came into my thinking when I was finishing off my thesis and when I've spoken about it at the tech conference this year and the DCP conference, is that what I want to share with people and what I've offered out and what's been taken up by two localities, quite big localities, thankfully, is that I've offered out my approach, my methodology. So this is the questionnaire that I used, and this is the program I use on, which isn't, I know that's not pure open science, but it's
any towards, small step. It's that. Yeah. Any small step is fantastic. And one thing that I wanted to stress in the talk that I gave, and I think it's really important to reiterate here, is that it's very much not an all or nothing thing. It's not like, if you're not making your data open, if you're not making your methods open, there's no point, you're not doing it right. It's very much, I want to avoid giving across that impression. I want to try and gently encourage people to do whatever little that they can, because that, even a small thing, is a really good step in the right direction. And you can take as much or as little as you want. If you feel comfortable pre-registering a study, trying to publish a registered report, which I'll explain in a second, or whatever, great. But if not, putting up your data on the Open Science Framework as an Excel spreadsheet, that small step's fantastic. And that's really, really great to encourage that. And speaking of data, actually, one of the things I want to do going forward personally is specifically with data, not only can you check for mistakes, but you can reuse it. Because how many, just for educational psychologists, how many TEPs have collected really great research? They've interviewed people, they've done this, that, or the other, and they've analyzed it in one way, which is great, but that data is so rich, there's so much more to it, but it's sitting on someone's hard drive and it never sees the light of day. And there is so much more information to be gained. Again, just going back to my thesis, I interviewed 30 people, and there's a lot of data there. I've analyzed it using one very basic thematic analysis method, because I'm not well-versed in qualitative research. And so I didn't feel comfortable going, like doing a grounded theory approach or something like that, or IPA. And so I didn't do that. But there is the scope to do that if next year someone wants to do a first year project on that, doing that exact thing or whatever. It means that the data can go so much further, and it allows the maximum use of that. Because someone, I can't remember who said this, but they made a really good point around, we've collected this data from participants, and if it's parents, if it's EPs, especially if it's young children as well, I almost feel like we have a duty to make the most of that, because they've given their time, they've given their thoughts, they've given their whatever. So we want to use it the best way possible. And if it's just, not just to get a thesis and sort of jump through that hoop, but if we can try and really deepen our understanding based on the research that's been conducted, that's fantastic. I think that'd be a really valuable opportunity. It doesn't have to be a full paper. It can be a first year project. It can be just reading them, because sometimes data in and of itself is fascinating to read. Because when Chris was chatting about in a couple of episodes ago about the focus groups they were doing, even just reading that data would be so interesting. They'll be really valuable to know. And so just making that open is then something that would have a lot of benefits, I feel, especially for practicing psychologists who would then want to directly work with those groups. So that's something that I would push, encourage.
Yeah, I think, I also think what would be really fascinating is, like, a lot of the conversations that I'm having in practice at the moment is about the validity of doing stuff which purports to be standardized. But then what I'm having to lay the case open to is, like, yes, that's standardized, but the children that we're working right now in our schools have had a non-standardized experience. Well, their standardized experience is somewhat different than the last 50, you know, up into the war experience of school. So and is this a chance now for EPs to come forth with a research approach which is open, useful directly to the schools that they're working with, but also to the broader community to see what's possible beyond what's behind university paywalls or behind journal paywalls or those sort of things. So it seems an exciting a kind of approach and idea, and which is entirely applicable to the strange new normal that we find ourselves in, but we could perhaps take a hopeful step towards a more open, ethical, transparent, accessible way of doing something that we base our profession on.
Absolutely. And in my EPS, we've been having a similar discussion around standardization of the different tools that we use. What does that mean? Are they then applicable to the population that we work with? And that's been really great to open up that dialogue around. So we've been looking at all the different kinds of tests that we might use. And a lot of the time, there isn't information about who it was standardized on. Some of it's like the brief has a really detailed breakdown of who it was standardized on, and that was really interesting. But a lot of the things that we use, there's no information at all about who it's been standardized on. And so do we know, are we confident that the tool that we might be using is valid for the young person that we are working with? I think that's a really important discussion to be had. And that plays into this idea of understanding open science. And that's why I think it's really valuable to talk about. Even if you never conduct a piece of research in your life again, understanding these things is so directly applicable to what we do as practicing psychologists, and those principles around going to check the data or seeing who it's standardized on, as a specific example, is something that is, as I said, directly applicable.
I'm coming to that conversation that Chris had with me, you know, a few episodes ago. This is our way of challenging the system, of wriggling out of a straitjacket and you know, opening up how we are. So before we kind of get onto, we've talked a little bit about kind of some applications in education psychology around kind of research and using ideas that come from that research, because there's probably you know, a real dormant, as you say, like everybody in the last 10 or so years has had to do a doctoral thesis to become an education psychologist. How many of those gone through to publishing it? I mean, I intend to do it, but I haven't yet because I'm...
I'm busy, but it also
emotionally feels like that was good enough for my external and internal examiner. But what I don't want to do is then get excited, put that to somebody, and it doesn't fit with where they're at the moment and what they're doing. So that's to a large extent that stay dormant. And I have talked about it on the podcast. I have gone to conferences and talked about it. But there would seem to be, if I could talk directly to just EPs about the idea, rather than going through all those kind of hoops to make it, you know, something that's worth doing for that journal, then the ideas could spread quicker, you'd hope.
Strongly agree, definitely. And one thing that I alluded to earlier is I am very critical of peer review as an institution. I think my take might be a bit too spicy that we should get rid of peer review entirely, probably a bit too out there for most people, which I fully appreciate. But there are alternatives to going down that route of trying to make it fit with a journal, then getting pushback or whatever it is, whatever experience that might be had. And one alternative is preprints, which I'm a really big fan of. And preprint is simply a PDF of the research, whatever it might be, and you put it on a public repository. It then has a DOI number, so you can be cited if that would be useful for the future, but it's also really good just to have. And it then serves as a public record of the thing that you did. And it's then publicly available, which is great. And there's no barrier to entry. You just go to the OSF website, preprint, you can upload it in seconds, if not minutes, and you put your conflict of interests and maybe one other thing that you talk about. You might link to a public repository if you've got data available, and then it's available. You then don't have to worry about the faff of going through the journal process, the reviews, this, that, or the other. And one of the critiques, one of the pushbacks to preprints that I often hear is that it would mean rubbish gets published. Just anyone would take anything that they've done, just throw it on a preprint server and just leave it at that. But that's generally not what's being seen at the moment, because people who tend to conduct research are generally sort of high, maybe not high in conscientiousness, but certainly EPs are. Academics in general, maybe not quite as high, but generally want to produce good quality work. But this ties into something I said earlier around academia in general slowing down, because the rate of published literature is, it's impossible to keep up. If you were, even if you spent all your day just reading papers in your specific area, you would never catch up. You'd fall further and further and further behind, because just so much is published. And preprints, I think, are really valuable, but they do tie in with that idea of slowing science down, being more thoughtful, being more precise, doing better quality research. And that's why I'm a big advocate of preprints. And another something that ties in with this is the idea of collaborative science, because there's been moves recently, specifically with a group called the Psychological Accelerator, where they get different groups of researchers together from all over the world, and they all commonly agree to do the same experiment. And so then you go from one researcher or a small group of researchers working with one university cohort or a subsection of that to thousands upon thousands of participants across the world. And whilst that might not be feasible for, say, educational psychologists, I think the principles are really valuable, because we don't have to just do work by ourselves. That's the status quo. But if we're talking about challenging the status quo, why can't we do something like a collaborative thesis or a master's thesis? And this is being done. This is, I think, Cardiff started doing this for the undergrad and for masters. Bath and Bristol have done it as well. Maybe not for the doctorate, but just bringing in this idea of collaborative research, because collaborative research is a super important skill to have, but also you increase the number of the amount of work that can be done because more people are combining together, you're pooling resources, because one of the big things with theses, doctoral, and especially for undergrad and masters, is that they're given no resources. Any resources that are provided come from the person, from the student themselves. And so that necessarily limits what you can do. But if you've got people pooling together, you have a greater chance of being able to explore something, perhaps, maybe not in a more meaningful way, but just more options available to you. So I think that would be quite a cool idea to try and it also help go against the status quo of everyone out for themselves, because you are literally collaborating. So that is the mentality that you're approaching. So you're kind of slowly pushing back against that status quo by doing things that are better, that might not benefit you in the immediate term, but they make your scholarship better. And then you can be more confident in the results, which I think is something that's really cool. And obviously, setting us, going back to what we're talking about with the getting rid of peer review, again, probably too spicy, but just that idea of allowing all those theses or the data that's been collected, having those open, having them accessible to everyone is great. And I think doctoral theses generally are quite available, but that might just be if you have the university affiliation. I can't quite remember if you can get it if you don't. And so if you can't, then that becomes immediately apparent that that research is valuable, we want to know about it, but we can't because it's being held up because of, and understandably, I know a bunch of people who have recently qualified and who haven't published their doctoral theses, even though they're really interesting, because they're busy being a full-time educational psychologist, or they don't want to, as you were saying, go through the rigmarole of applying for a journal, going through that, because there are horror stories of journals taking forever. And obviously, journals are generally run by psychologists for free, which is also madness, but anyway. And so they're not doing this nefariously, but it's just a system that for me isn't fit for purpose. And so subverting it, going against that, doing things differently, I would definitely recommend, encourage people to do. And hopefully putting your thesis is already a PDF. You could go and put it on as a preprint server in a few minutes, and then it's publicly available for everyone to read, which is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's a couple of things that kind of popped up in my head whilst you were talking about that kind of collaborative approach to research kind of worldwide. But, it's something that perhaps like psychology services could do. They could, do research in all of like action research in all their schools and get a sort of sense of the standardization of that, that kind of ecology, and kind of what works for each school. You could do it between kind of training providers. It's kind of work. And I guess my experience of academia is that it can be quite lonely. You're suggesting something that is very different from that, very connected, at one with the field, rather than trying to either fit in with what the field wants or direct where the field is going. So that's exciting. And I guess with the kind of preprint and that idea, anybody could print anything. I guess there's sort of this sense that journals protect us from that. And I guess part of a new idea is it's like, oh, this is a new idea. It seems like a good idea, but what's protecting me from quote unquote bad ideas or bad research? You've been in these communities for 6 years now. So what kind of resources are available for people who are interested in experiencing and investigating open psychology? Where would you suggest that they go to start on that journey?
That's a really great question. I think for me, the main resource that I found, which was really valuable, was probably going on Twitter. There is a caveat though, because the movement has changed in this time, understandably. There's much more, to be honest, there's actually much more of an emphasis now on, for want of a better word, a social justice element, which I think is a positive change, because when it first started, it was very much, let's just focus on methods, let's just try and improve those statistical ideas. And there's been much more of a shift towards understanding different communities, the impact that might have, and ideas that as EPs we're probably already thinking about. So that was really positive. Other resources that would be useful. So searching the Open Science Framework, osf.io is the website. They've got quite a few primers on there where it talks about like open data, or it talks about open methods and that sort of thing. So that can be quite a good, hopefully gentle introduction to some of those ideas. And then it might explain things like pre-registration, which is the idea that before you analyze your data qualitatively or quantitatively, you publicly declare what you're going to do. And it's a way to try and minimize this crafting of a narrative of, oh, I was going to do this all along, and the variables that I explored, the people that I interviewed, whatever, I was never, that never happened. I didn't do that. And so it's just being open and honest about that. The step up from pre-registration, because I used to be a massive fan of pre-registration. I'm very much cooled to it at the moment. But what I think would be really interesting is certainly becoming more popular. It's still developing, but this idea of registered reports, and this is more specific to publication, because what you do is you design your study and then you have it reviewed by peer reviewers before you collect the data. Now, setting aside my criticisms of peer review, I think this is actually quite a cool idea, because there are a number of studies out there that you read the paper and there's a fatal flaw in the methodology, or something means that it is dead on arrival, that it had no hope of finding anything meaningful. So if you have that peer review, or you have that review prior to the data analysis, you can be more sure that you haven't wasted your time, the participants' time, and everyone else's time. Mm-hmm. I don't think there are any journals yet that offer registered reports specifically for educational psychology, but it's something that is expanding in the public consciousness. And so, with looping back to your original question about resource and everything, I think there are some primers. I think was it Bristol University? Maybe UCL? No, it must have been UCL, because I was part of a series on different open science primers. One of them was the one I contributed to was Open Data, and there are other ones available, and they're all preprints, they're all publicly available, and that can then give you an avenue to what preprints are by just going onto a preprint server. I can probably give you a list of things.
Yeah, we'll put it in the description, and
yeah, definitely
kind of one-stop shop for
things to check out. Yeah, definitely
things to check out.
And to reiterate what we were saying earlier, it's very much picking and choosing different parts. It's not you have to subscribe to all these things, because there's a very heated debate around whether pre-registration is valuable or valid or not. And that's good. Having that, obviously, as long as it's a respectful debate, that's a really valuable way, because we have to critically analyze things. We have to think about the things that we're proposing. Are they fit for purpose? Are they good? It's not just let's put anything forward and then we don't critically analyze that. That would defeat the whole point of it. And so having that open debate around those new methodologies is really interesting. And slowly picking up things that you like, having a better understanding of things, because if you never conduct research again, having an understanding that the data was open, or the methodology is open, or it's been better validated, this, that, the other, that gives you more confidence to critically analyze a paper that you've read or a methodology you've come across, because you know what to look for.
Yeah. And I guess another thing that I guess might concern people who are used to the traditional ways of doing things is obviously there's a meta ethics to doing open psychology, but with the, you know, the nitty-gritty ethics that we deal with in research, things of, you know, anonymity, consent, all of those sort of things. Is there guidance within the open science community about how to word that, how to approach that? I'm guessing there would be.
That's a really great question, and something that I'm really glad has been discussed in that community, because there are templates, there are primers about how to do that. And because asking participant permission and saying in the, and explaining to them that this research, so to take my thesis as an example, I included in the consent form, and I briefly talked about it with the participants, that this research will be anonymized, but then I will be making it publicly available. So the transcripts of all my interviews and all my other data is going to go on the OSF, which I mentioned earlier, because that's just a massive data repository where you can just chuck stuff on. Also, as a side note, having, even just using the OSF, even if you don't post any of your data on there, using it as a data, as a place to store data is really valuable, because it was about a week or two ago, my desktop completely exploded, and I had my thesis on my desktop. Thankfully, I have an external hard drive, and I had it saved to a external resource, the OSF in this case, but it completely, out of nowhere, it's very old, so perhaps not to be, perhaps not too surprising, but me having that saved on the OSF, if say my hard drive failed at the same time, would hurt. It saves me from potentially losing my thesis about a month out from the deadline. And if that had happened, I'd honestly just have gone and walked into the sea, because the idea of having to rewrite my entire thesis in a month after doing so much would have just been so awful. So even if you never use it, and it doesn't have to be data, it can be anything. You can just chuck stuff on there and use it as a place to store things.
So is it a secure...
Sorry, yes, yeah. I should also emphasize that, yeah, you have it private if you want, but it is also secure. But it, because it is a public repository, you should only ever put anonymized data on there. It shouldn't be people's names or all the other classic things that you would want to make public. And so, but there are templates, as I said, there are primers on how to approach this in a way that keeps the participants informed, respects their rights, but also tries to live up to those open science values of having things open so it can be explored and reused.
Yeah, great. Okay. So I think I've got quite a good idea about kind of the ethics of it, the community that it could bring into it. This seems like a very valid, structured alternative, and perhaps something that education psychologists can and could develop in our own kind of little profession that we've got, to join us up to the bigger psychological community, when it seems that once we leave our universities, that's usually the end of the time that we have open access to things. So kind of, I guess a concluding point, what would you say that, you know, the EP community could do to become more open? What are the kind of first steps that you'd suggest?
I think one thing would be to, I suppose it's hard for me to say one thing, because I don't want to just say that this is the one thing you should start with. And so I guess getting an understanding of what the different options are, because then you can kind of pick and choose which bits seem feasible for you. Because obviously, if, for example, if you're a TEP, you're learning so much, like your mind is absolutely overflowing with stuff all the time. And so perhaps the thought of learning, oh, I've got to now redo how I explore research, can seem quite daunting. And so having a more fine-grained or more small-scale approach to it might be more manageable. And then the same applies to EPs as well. If they've got full caseload, if they're writing EHCPs all the time, it's really daunting to think, oh, I have to relearn how I'm doing or how I'm consuming research. And I really don't think it's like that, because these are small steps that can be taken, which can have large impacts. And I think if we as a community start taking these small steps towards that, I think that'll be really positive, because it would then make our work more accessible to those that we work with. I think that's really important. And those different things, the different parts of open science, are some are easy to do, some are harder to do. So as I said, picking and choosing what things work is really valuable. And also, I'm probably too active on Twitter, so you can always ask me about things. Yeah. You can send me an email. And so I'm very happy to talk about these sorts of things and offer guidance, because I really like it and I think it's really interesting. And so I want to, and also, as I said earlier, be an example of that by making my data open, putting it up as a preprint, and having, or at least having it open access, whether I use a preprint server or not is a moot point, because what I want to do also is have a positive impact and try and help anyone I can. That's my MVP. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that kind of you taking leadership on this within the profession is important. I think people will be really interested to hear and read about your thesis research, particularly about its consultation. Lots of people use consultation, and to have that kind of that common theme to as a kind of gateway to how you could do stuff in a more open way would be fantastic.
For example,
So you tweet regularly in English and in Spanish, I think.
I do, yes.
So if you're multilingual, Patrick's your man. Well, what is your Twitter handle?
So it's at PSY Brief, because for years I still have the blog, but I wrote a blog under a pseudonym, and I dropped. So I go as Patrick, but I still keep my name and everything, because I'd done that for like 6 or 7 years or so. So I was like, time for a change, mix it up. But yeah, if you want to follow me, awesome. If you want to ask me a question, also very, very happy to chat about that sort of thing. If you go, so you can also, as I said, you can send me an email if you want, which is, so I've got an academic website which has a contact email for me there, which you can also find on my Twitter bio. So you just click that and go to there. And also I'm going to be using that as a place where I'm keeping all of my research. So that can be like a one-stop shop for research that I've done now, research that I hope to do in the future, and just make that all available. So yeah, that's my plan going forward.
Awesome. Well, it sounds really exciting.
Thank you.
I'm going to say to listeners, let's give Patrick until a few months before we bombard him, because he's in the middle of finishing his thesis.
After the 28th, feel free to send me all the questions you want. But yeah, at the moment, my mind is a little bit full with the thesis.
But I'd like to say it's been a really enlightening conversation, Patrick. I've learned loads more about something that I've been very inspired and curious about for the last couple of years since I first heard you talk. So it's been a real pleasure talking to you, and you know, you're clearly an exciting trainee who will be a great educational psychologist in the near future. But thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really, really enjoyed it, and thank you for the kind words. That's very, very, very much appreciated, and I hope I live up to the hype.
No problem. Good luck, Patrick.
Thank you so much.